Total Eclipse of the Heart. One of my favorites right there. Bonnie Tyler on Coast to Coast AM. That's the tearjerker tune that we all know, that song and that feeling. Well, thank you for joining us tonight or this morning, wherever you are. You're listening to Coast AM. Again, I'm Connie Willis. And we are talking tonight with John Ventry from MUFON, an eyewitness of the Kecksburg incident, Owen Eichler, and his theory, his new theory, of what happened. So we're getting into that, and we're going to give you more information on that and see where we think and see what you think, because we're going to take your phone calls as well. If you please can check out coasttocoast.com or coasttocoastam.com, you can see the picture that Owen sent us and also a drawing too, so that will also give you a nice visual too. So again, here at Coast to Coast AM, this is where we make it safe for you to tell your story. So stick around. We've got more on the Kecksburg incident and a possibly new theory to solve it all on Coast to Coast AM. With stations all over the U.S., North America, Puerto Rico, Guam, and by satellite, we are Coast to Coast AM. Hello, everybody. I'm your host, Connie Willis. We are talking about one of the top five UFO cases, Kecksburg, and Owen Eichler is with us, an eyewitness of the event, who also has researched this forever and now has his theory. And we also have with us MUFON director from Pennsylvania, John Ventry. And John, why are you a part of Owen and this theory? Why are you with us on this?
Okay. Well, Owen had brought this theory to MUFON back in February of this year, and they referred it to me because Owen lives in Southwest PA, and I'm the Pennsylvania State Director, so it comes to me. And I told Owen, you know, you got to sell me on this. You got to give me some facts. You got to prove a number of points to me. And he really has. Now, for myself, if you think about our investigations with MUFON, we prove about 80% of the UFO cases we can match up to identifiable objects, man-made objects, the space station, asteroids, etc. So we do match up about 80%. And then, in my opinion, about 10% of the cases that we get are hoaxes. And that leaves us with 10% that are the true unexplainables and the unidentifiables. But, you know, I feel obligated, although, you know, I'm rooting for the UFO. I'm rooting for the UFO here, too. You know, I'm always rooting for the UFO because that's what I enjoy. But, you know, if you got a good theory, and I told Owen, look, I will help you get it out there. It's his theory. It's not my theory. I helped him with a number of points on it, but it's his theory. I said, if you give me the evidence, I'm obligated to bring it forward. I would never try to cover something up just so I can say it's a UFO, you know. I wouldn't try to say, oh, it's the alien autopsy or the Roswell picture if it's a fake, you know. I'm going to bring the truth out. And he's got a very, very good theory.
What percentage would you say if you were looking at a percentage of how correct you think this might be?
I think he's 90 to 95% correct. He hits on, 9 out of 10 points.
Okay. That's pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I don't think you have that with any of the other theories, do you?
What was that?
I don't think you have that with any of the other theories.
No, I can shoot holes in a number of the others. I think the two biggest things here is when you look at the Jerry Betters drawing, which was done on December 9th, 1965, and you compare it to this GE Mark II. And just to clarify for the listening audience, we're talking about a spy capsule is what this was. There was also, it could have been used for a nuclear missile also, but we don't believe that this ever had a nuclear missile in it. It did have a radioactive power source, and we'll talk about that when you listen to the descriptions of the witnesses. But a comparison of what it looked like to the Jerry Betters picture is right on, and he explained how this thing turned. That was the biggest issue I had. Because when we're thinking about making turns, you know, you're thinking about, well, somebody's in the craft and he's got a steering wheel or some way of making turns. So it's intelligently controlled under, operation of an ET. But in his theory, he proved to me that the blunt surface had a weight and balance inside it. It was made to be able to turn side to side, the blunt surface of the capsule on the bottom against the friction of the air would slow it down. If it leaned to one side, it would turn. It would turn the other way. And there's a statement that we came up with that these were made to make control landings on Earth. So he proved the most, the part that I thought was most difficult, he proved it.
So, Owen, can you talk to that? I know that, you know, John, that you keep, you mentioned the better guy. He, I know he also was hoping for the UFO as well. So, Owen, tell us your explanation of the going to the left, going to the right, and landing nicely, not, you know, a crash.
All right. Well, I would like to also augment this a little bit with why it took so long for us to identify this RV. One of the problems, if you look at the picture, the cone end of the picture, most people would assume that cone would be the front end, and you would see that cone at the top of a rocket. That's just a natural assumption. Well, when I went through and did all my research, I wondered why can't I find a rocket with this reentry vehicle on top with a point? Then it clicked. It took me a long time. I found a picture of the mating rocket. This picture, I don't know if you have it on your site.
Yep, we have it up on the website. Yes,
Do you have the one that's laying on a flatbed truck?
The sketch? The sketch?
No, this is an actual picture of a rocket on a flatbed truck.
Oh, no, we need to get that one.
All right, well, I'll describe it for the listeners.
Okay.
It shows the receiving end of the top of the rocket of where the nose cone portion of this RV would fit right into the rocket. It shows the exact same angles that this RV has that match inside the rocket. So what we were looking at all of those years and all these rockets and many, many pictures was the blunt end, the flat end, is the part that was mostly seen from the outside. And all these hundreds of launches, but like I said, it clicked when I saw that rocket laying on a flatbed getting ready to receive one of these MK2 reentry vehicles. And there was an aha moment there, not for my disbelief, but because if I had to prove this to somebody, I had to show a rocket with some way for this reentry vehicle to fit into it.
And there you go.
Hey, Owen, I think it's also important to point out that this was a secret spy program, and the earliest documents regarding it was in 1991 when it started to show up. It was released and started to show up in textbooks and manuals. So that means somebody had to actually find it in these manuals and say, oh, that's it. There wasn't a FOIA release and say, okay, here's the Keksberg capsule, this is it. So for the first 26 years after Keksberg, there was no mention of this because it was a secret spy program. It started showing up in 1991, and then you have to find it. You have to read these manuals and say, oh, look at that. It looks like it.
It's a secret. So when the eyewitnesses all say, we believe, when they all say military was there, and then you hear people say Army, but there were other people that said Air Force as well, and then NASA. So if it's a secret spy piece that fell, then would it be NASA? Would it be Army? Would it be Air Force?
Well,
how would they all know about this?
This is all Air Force. NASA was only involved from an advisory point of view. As a matter of fact, the Air Force didn't even share the information they had because it was linked with the CIA as well. But they weren't going to share the information with anybody. They had complete control of their project from the time it left the constructed rockets and warheads left Vandenberg, went to England, and from England to Johnson Island. It was all Air Force.
And Connie, here's another important point. NASA said that this wasn't tracked, it was not tracked. But think about this. At 4:48 in the afternoon, this thing comes down, and by 5:30, you've got 24 Army personnel armed on the scene. You have 3 Air Force people and 4 NASA people there within 45 minutes. This had to be tracked on radar, even though they said it wasn't. It had to be. They wouldn't show up that quickly. And at that time, Project Moondust had protocol in place on what to do if something crashed, if it was a UFO, if it was a Soviet object. These protocols were in place, and they exactly followed the protocols. They wouldn't do that for a meteor, and that's very important.
Absolutely.
They lied when they said it wasn't tracked on radar because it was. They couldn't get there that quickly if it wasn't tracked.
So I understand. I believe that wholeheartedly. They knew, you know, they were going to something that they knew they had a, they knew something, they knew something. But here's the question. If you say, Owen, that it was the Air Force and NASA consulted, why would the Army be there?
The Army probably provided transportation, extra transportation. Then again, we don't know if they had borrowed a truck. Of course, you know, there was a star on the side of the truck, which would signify Army. But the Army would have even much less to do with it than NASA.
Well, to get back to the one answer that you were going to answer, and that was how did it guide itself down and make turns?
Yes, let me preview that with just about a minute of history here on
sure.
this.
Sure, okay.
MK2 reentry vehicle followed something called a blunt body design. This was a design that the Germans were working on in the late 1930s. They were figuring out how to get a nuclear device on top of a rocket and send it to New York. They actually had a rocket called the A-10 they were in the middle of designing before they ran out of resources and time. Those scientists that worked on that were part of the ones that came here to originally Alabama under Project Paperclip. They continued their research, and they had a team of guys working on the analysis of this particular reentry vehicle. There's a really good paper I found, it's in my references, made by two scientists, Allen and Eggers, that did extensive wind tunnel tests based on the German scientists' designs. And they had discovered, just quite by accident, what most people would say couldn't work. Most people would say you would want to have a reentry vehicle with a sharp pointed cone coming into the atmosphere. Well, what happens, the front end of that cone, the sharp point, just burns away due to the heat of friction. So these guys turned it backwards, and they put the blunt body going forward and discovered in wind tunnel tests and through actual tests that were done out in New Mexico, under, I can't remember the name of that project right now, but it's easy to find if people want to look at it on the internet. It's called Green Fireballs. There was a test, series of tests going on in the 40s, late 40s, where people witnessed these very same things that we saw in Kecksburg. And they came in a flurry. There might be 4 or 5 launched in a week and then slowed down, a few more launched in a week and then slowed down. I believe John's familiar with this.
Yeah, there was actually a professor, Dr. LaPaz, who's famous for this, in tracking these green fireballs. And this is kind of pre, Kecksburg and this technology. They saw these green fireballs all the time coming down in New Mexico, not knowing what they were. And it turned out it was the testing of this design with the copper heat shield on it. And that explains another UFO mystery of the green fireballs.
And so, thank you, John. And so to continue on, there was a few developments. The first, General Electric first designed an MK-1, then they moved to an MK-2, and then after the MK-2, they went to a new reentry vehicle designed by Avco, which was an ablative. It had an ablative coating on it, which I'll explain. But I wanted to get the point across that was very interesting, this counterintuitive design where they could actually protect the vehicle from heat by pushing a large portion of compressed air out in front of the reentry vehicles that came down through. And it preserved the nuclear load, and it preserved any camera or film or anything else they wanted to put on it. Very, very smart engineering. The last thing here was the Mark III I wanted to talk about by Avco. That replaced the MK2 in England when they took out the MK2 and the Thor rockets. The ablative design is completely different. They actually did use a pointed nose cone, but instead of a big heavy copper heat sink, they went to a coating material of resins and plastics that actually burnt off and took the heat away from the nose cone as it come down through the atmosphere. It was a much better design, and it replaced the MK2. And how the MK2 wound up in Johnson Island, they really had nothing else to do with it but keep it on stock. And that's how we came around to the Kecksburg incident. They had developed a two specific packages were called AP1 and AP2. And AP stood for auxiliary package. And we pretty much come to the conclusion that the auxiliary package was a camera and film they had in the MK2. Why they did that is still a mystery, because at the time they were coming out with Project Keyhole. And John, would you like to explain more about Keyhole?
Project Keyhole? No, I don't.
Wow, Owen, you're doing a great job. I'm in trance here. Go ahead. Let me.
Okay.
You've got me going here. So tell me that one.
The Keyhole project was a series of reentry vehicles. It first started out with one camera, then went to two cameras, then to three cameras. Project Keyhole was already established, and they were using it quite regularly. They wouldn't have had a need to go to an old Mark II reentry vehicle unless they had some very special experimental thing they wanted to do, which in fact is what they did. The launches that we're targeting as far as Kecksburg would have been the APX-1, the first one, because it is listed as it depends on what reference you look at. Sometimes they say it failed, sometimes it didn't. So my point was that they already had a program in place, a Keyhole program. It was also called Corona. Maybe that's why I threw you, John.
Yeah, I never heard of Keyhole. I heard of Corona.
Yeah, I've heard of Corona. Mm-hmm.
They started Keyhole 1, Keyhole 2, and all the way up to Keyhole 4. And so they were already in operation. And they used the ablative design for that. So basically, this was a dinosaur reentry vehicle that they put an experimental package on and sent it into space as part of Project 437. So we're thinking that maybe they were doing that because they were in a hurry. The Russians had just announced that they weren't going to, they were going to lift the moratorium before this was launched. Just weeks before this was launched, the Russians were going to lift the moratorium they had on going into space for the purpose of attacking somebody else's satellite. So that's how we came about to having our suspicions of Johnson Island and the launch that landed in Kecksburg.
If you're just joining us, you're hearing the voice of Owen Eichler. He was one of the eyewitnesses of the famous Kecksburg incident. We're also talking with John Ventry, the Pennsylvania MUFON director, and we are seeing if we might have, well, it is the fifth theory of a top UFO case, the top one of top five, and that is of Kecksburg. Interesting information, I'm telling you. We've got more to come with these guys, and we're going to take your phone calls, too. And so you can talk to him and ask him what you'd like to. That's more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Hotel California and the Eagles right there. The memory of that is skating. That was when all the skating was happening as a kid. And that was like when they turned the lights down and they had the like disco ball, you know, going. And that was like the slow skate. So you got to have, you know, your little backward skating and the guy in front of you pushing you kind of thing. And that was dating back then as a kid. So now, guess what? There's new dating. It's called Paranormal Date, right here on Coast to Coast AM, ParanormalDate.com. For those of you that want to date someone of like minds, well, you can do that. This was created by George himself, George Norrie, and a friend of his. They put this together, and now you can meet people of like mind that will also discuss this with you and not be disgusted with you. We now have over 26,000 members. And that's absolutely, I mean, in the amount of time it's been on, that's incredible. It's available in Canada, too. It's free to sign up. You can use code George for a nice discount. Hey, you know, and if anybody gets married, anything really cool comes from this, we want to know about it. So it's ParanormalDate.com, brought to you by Coast to Coast AM. It's another very interesting show here on Coast to Coast AM, the real theater of the mind. Connie Willis here talking about the Kecksburg incident. We have John Ventry, the Pennsylvania director of MUFON, and we also have with us one of the eyewitnesses with his own theory here tonight. That's Owen Eichler. Owen, I'd like to talk to you first here on this segment, and I'd like to know, I want to know about your theories, why you give me the reasons for them. Give me, let's see. Let me throw a couple things out to you. Some of the guys saw blue smoke and they saw blue lights. How would you explain that? And how would you also explain Murphy when, you know, who would have went to him to say, shut up, change your radio program that you're about to let everybody else hear?
Well, that's interesting enough. I guess all of us have this feeling that it was the service, Secret Service, somebody coming in and giving Murphy a hard time. I know I don't really have any details on that. I haven't really talked to anybody about that. I think I just always assumed that there would always be somebody with black suits and sunglasses, no matter what you did,
that had to
do with national security.
Okay, so you still say that. And for those of you, WHJB reporter John Murphy was there on the scene. He came back, and he was going to do this great documentary on the radio, and he was really excited about it. And at one point, two guys had told him, and this is like a long story short, or a short story shorter, they had said something to him to where he changed his show. And it scared him enough. And he never told what was said and what was taken out. So would your theory make it to where something like that would occur? Would it be that strong?
Well, it's understandable. If people were going to go by what I've been saying about this and all the top secret military programs that were involved, and geez, how many thousands of pages of PDF files I've read through over the years of the government involvement, it just goes along with the program. You would think people would say there probably is going to be somebody in black hats and black suits.
And what were you going to say, John?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me jump in. In my book, UFOs Over PA, I have it documented where James Oberg, who later became the spokesman for NASA, made a statement, and he said that Air Force officers would routinely pose as NASA agents because they could be in a suit, they couldn't be in their uniform. So, and NASA never knew this went on. And this could even be part of the Men in Black theory, that NASA would take their uniform off, I mean, the Air Force would take their uniform off, put a suit on, and pretty much pose as NASA agents and go investigate and talk to people. And those are the people that went to Murphy and took his film and shut him up. But the main reason, there were two main reasons why that happened. One was, at the time, this was a spy program, and we couldn't let the Russians know we were spying on them. They didn't know we were doing this, that it actually had a camera in there, and we were spying on them. And the second reason is that when this thing crashed into the woods, the witnesses said they saw four NASA guys in moon suits carrying a 4x4 box into the woods. This thing had a radioactive power source, not a nuclear weapon, and a radioactive power source. They had to retrieve that because they couldn't drive it out of the area leaking radiation. Those were the two reasons that Murphy was silenced.
Well, how'd they get it up on that truck so quickly? I mean, it seemed like they knew what was going on. I mean, It didn't seem to be a problem to do it so quickly.
Remember, it had those rings on it. You could lift it. And Owen, I think, believe, came up with it weighed 1,500 pounds. And you've got 25 military guys there. I mean, you could lift this thing up or put bands on it, straps, and lift it. I was talking to Stan Gordon just in July at the Kecksburg conference, and I asked him the same thing. And he said that he had information of a second truck that went into the area with a winch on it that was able to lift it up and put it on the flatbed.
Owen, what do you say to that?
Well, the weight on it empty is 1,500 pounds. I have some information that shows me that it was as high as 3,500 pounds that was carrying a warhead at the time. And keep in mind, back in those days, those warheads were bulky. The W-49 warhead was very bulky. So it could have went up to 3,500 pounds. But that also explains why they put thruster rockets on the standard Thor rocket to launch them, because they're very heavy.
Well, weren't there a couple different discrepancies regarding the size of the object as well from witnesses?
Yes, many. John and I have talked this over quite a bit, and it comes down to one of those things where I believe many people have seen some shows on television. There was one on not too awful long ago where they took a group of people out and showed them various points on a hike, and they brought them back and they sat them down individually and asked them what they saw, and they had six people that had six different stories. So
right.
It's kind of common that people see things differently. We have to keep in mind too that it was dark when the witnesses were there. Many people, we don't know how close they got to it. Obviously, one guy did, because he saw the hieroglyphics, is what he called them. But that might have only been one fellow. So we have size ranges anywhere from, I believe Stan Gordon had said in his documentary that was 10 foot by 10 foot, maybe 10 foot wide, 10 foot long. There are other people that have said maybe 8 or maybe 6. And then you have to keep in mind, too, if it was that big, now we're getting up to some heavier weights, 5,000 pounds or better, maybe more, and there wasn't a rocket at the time that could lift that. So we doubt the big sizes. Now, the actual size of the MK2 that we're talking about, actual size is 5'2" at the base and somewhere around 5'2" at the height. Now, if that was halfway buried in a hillside, which is what we've gotten as far as eyewitness testimony, no one would really know how long it was. They would only know how broad or how wide it was. And we do know we have another person, a witness, that said it looked like a man could almost stand up in it. He didn't
right.
say a man could stand in it. He said it could almost stand up in it.
Okay, I remember that. I was going to ask you about that one.
And then one witness, Ernie Hoffman, who was there, said he was actually surprised because it looked like two suitcases sitting on the flatbed. He said it was small. It was not very large. The size of two suitcases is what he described.
Well, we've had a lot of researchers definitely looking into this for a long time. Of course, we all know Stan Gordon is like, this is his baby. We also, Leslie King has really researched this as well. You have anything to say about what she's found out and what she says, as well as Stan?
That would
either
be
one
your,
of you?
Bailiwick, John.
As far as what they say about it, they never found this GE Mark II as one of the explanations, because it wasn't available until 1991, and nobody has ever brought this one forward as one of the explanations. So I think as we move a little further through this, we'll be able to explain every one of the questions that came up, and I can recap it a little bit later also.
Well, does this also work with Dr. Ray Hicks, who investigated the trees and he saw the damage in the rings in the year reported? Would what you're saying have affected the trees as well?
Well, you know, it took those trees down. We know it had a radioactive power source in it, and that's why I'm convinced that the four guys carrying a 4x4 box into the woods was most likely a lead box. They had to remove that power source in case it was leaking, and that's what they put in the box, and they carried it out of the woods like the Ark of the Covenant.
Okay, that would explain the box. Owen, is that how you say talk about the box as well?
I would go along with it. They did pull out the radioactive thermal generator. They would have to keep it protected, of course. And we owe a little explanation about the radioactive thermal generator for the audience.
Okay.
This was a relatively small piece of equipment that was pretty much designed early in the 60s and was being phased in on all the nuclear reentry vehicles and programs to provide extra power, because the more things they put on these spacecraft, and it wasn't just the MK2, there's plenty of satellites circulating in space right now with defunct nuclear reactors on them, small ones, and nuclear sources. So it had been around for a while, but what we had here was something that's shaped like a tube. If you can imagine something maybe about 24 inches long and 6 inches in diameter, inside of it is a radioactive source. Cesium is one of the elements they used at the time. Radium was another element they used at the time. And it was discovered a long time ago, if you had enough, let's say, of radium together of a good percentage mix, in other words, it was refined, pretty well refined, it doesn't explode, but it'll sit and give off heat. And what they did then was just insert thermocouples and multiple thermocouples, which they call thermopals, into the mix, the element, or however they used it. There were different ways they used it. What you could do is generate enough heat for the thermocouple to make power on the order of maybe 45 to 90 kilowatts of power. And that would be enough to run instrumentation, which we can talk about later, run communications, run films, and also run the control systems for steering and guiding this reentry vehicle. So they would have been important to make sure that in the crash, which obviously was absorbed, the amount of force that was involved in the crash was absorbed by the ground and the trees and the angle it came in. It probably wouldn't have been a problem, but they couldn't be for sure. So they, as John said, they would more than likely try to isolate that source before anything else.
So you said there were four that were unaccounted for, is that right, of these?
No, there were four launches, and
four launches.
One that was unaccounted for, and that's
what this is, okay.
Yeah, and if I can explain that.
Absolutely.
When Owen sent me all of his information, I read through it all, and I saw that on December 7th, there was one launch of those four from Johnson Island, and it doesn't list an outcome. And that's key. Like, where did this one go? Obviously, we're trying to find something that came down at 4:47 p.m. on December 9th, and on December 7th, there's one that doesn't list an outcome. So we looked into that one. This one launched at 7:29 p.m. It took 8 minutes and 18 seconds to get to where it needed to be. It was going to film a spent Atlas rocket that was just in space. It missed its mark by 0.56 nautical miles, so about a half a mile off. And it then ejected the film capsule, which was visible at 7:45 p.m. But there's, and that's what it would do. It would take pictures and eject the film capsule, and that's what they would recover. And most of these would just then later on, you know, eventually come down. They list, there were over 100 of these launches, and most of them will list the outcome, meaning when it came down, where it came down. This one does not list an outcome as to what happened to the capsule. And that's key, because we're looking for something that came down 39 hours later. So we started looking into that aspect. There's a five-hour time difference because of daylight savings time in 1965 from Johnson Island to Kecksburg. So we're looking at now something, could it stay in space for about 39 and a half hours before coming down? And Owen found that the launch on it was, it was going from pole to pole, so it was not going like from the equator. It was going around the Earth from pole to pole. And we said, can they take 39 hours to come down? And what was very important is on December 9th, there's another launch of another one from Vandenberg Air Force Base. It went out of control similarly to the December 7th. That one is listed with, as taking 2 days to come down. So we need something that takes 39 hours to come down, and there's one on the 9th that came down on the 11th, took 2 days. So it's absolutely feasible that the one launched on the 7th that doesn't list an outcome actually came down 39 hours later. And that's key to this theory. Plus the fact that even if NASA or the Air Force were to say, no, we know it came down, although they never listed that it came down, so you'd have to question that. There were hundreds of these that were launched. Owen even found one that came down 2 years later. So they take 8 minutes to get up there. If it came straight down without the rocket, maybe it took 20 minutes, or it could take 2 years. So our theory that it took 39 hours to come down into Kecksburg is absolutely feasible.
What do you think?
I'd like to add something there to capitalize on what John said. Being a film canister would be on board, they would want to get that film canister as fast as they could. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever that they would want to keep it up in the air that long. That's what leads us to believe that there was an in-space, either an in-space collision or an in-space problem with that particular reentry vehicle. And we have documentation that shows a long paragraph that we're not going to talk about in great detail, but it does show that particular launch had a problem with a harness, a cable harness, when they tried to release the capsule, when they tried to release the reentry vehicle from the rocket nose, they had a hang-up. So we have two reasons to believe that it stayed up there longer than it should have. There was a problem somewhere, and we can talk about that later.
Well, don't put everything off later, because we got phone calls coming up. So I definitely want you all to talk about things as you all want to talk about them. You all keep saying later, later. There's no later. It's now. So I'm just, you know, oh, man, I tell you, I mean, was it still worth it that much to hide something that we know is just a spy kind of thing to where it took the life of reporter John Murphy later that was killed strangely, struck by a car? I mean, Well, we've got more to come here with John Ventry and Owen Eichler talking about Kecksburg and the fifth theory of it. So stick around with us. And, hey, next hour, we're going to take your phone calls so you can ask them questions yourself. Okay, that's coming up here on Coast to Coast AM.